Right, it's now the 6th of February. It's just so before 11 o'clock in the morning, and we are again in the house of Pat and Vic Howarth. Pat is here when we start this morning. She wasn't last time. And we're going to continue the interview away, that we started a week ago.
I never left the village in the sense that I was always
What's the best way, do you think, to do it,
Yeah. So it's 2016, we should say the year.
Yes.
And Vic, we stopped somewhere last week around the time that you went to secondary.
Sorry, Vic, we'll just stop for a second.
Give us a run of your life following that period with regards to your career and any moves that you made, and how come you are back here in Cartmel today?
Okay. Well, I went to secondary school, which was then Ulverston Grammar School, from here, and I was there for, I think, 7 years to do the, it was called school certificate in those days, and higher school certificate, and then went on. I won a scholarship from Lancashire County Council to pay for me to go to university. But I went straight from school into the Royal Air Force to do my 2 years national service. In Germany it happened. I was finally posted to Wunstorf in Germany. After I was demobbed from the national service, I went to University College in London to do for a degree in physiology. After which, after I graduated, I remained as a demonstrator for a while for 2 years or so at University College, and then I married, 4 years, was it? Oh, all right, okay. So I graduated at University College and remained there for several years, 4 years apparently, as a kind of apprentice to A.D. Hill, who was then the sort of doyen of muscle physiology. So I became a muscle physiologist. From there, I moved on to the Marine Biological Laboratory at Plymouth because I had been working there as a visitor from time to time on matters concerning nerves. The reason being that in marine animals you get certain specialised nerves which makes it very easy to experiment on them. So that's what I did then, and I finally became a staff member at Plymouth Marine Biological Laboratory. I was there for the remainder of my career, really, except that from time to time I went off to work in other laboratories. I can't remember the dates at the moment, but I was a year and a bit at 18 months at the University of Illinois in America, working with a colleague there, came back to Plymouth, and later went off again for 2 years to Yale University in Connecticut in America, New Haven. And after I returned to Plymouth, I was...
And when did you come back to Cartmel, Vic?
12 years ago. When was that? 2003. Oh, my parents had always lived here in this house until they died, which I inherited half of it, along with my brother, and finally bought his half. And we moved back here from Cornwall, where we were living. That's when I was working in Plymouth.
2003.
2003, yes. Okay.
Oh, all right, came back in 2003.
Okay, that's good. Now,
I also worked briefly in the University of Bern with another colleague, but most of my career was in Plymouth and to do with muscles and nerves. I was the editor of the Plymouth Marine Biological Laboratory Journal for about 17 years, that was a second job, along with my research there. So all the scientists there did something else to do with the running of the laboratory, and I was the editor of the journal. It was an international scientific journal, so I spent a lot of time doing that sort of thing.
So if we come back to Cartmel...
I'm sorry, yes.
No, that's okay. And you mentioned that you went to secondary school in Ulverston.
Yes.
How did you get to Ulverston and back on a daily basis?
That was just a bus. I went by bus and came back by bus to the corner of the road. It was about an hour's journey.
Do you remember how much it cost, or was it free?
It wasn't free. My parents bought what we called a contract. That was certainly the beginning. Perhaps it became free later. I'm not too sure about that. But I do remember having to wait for this contract to come just before the beginning of term. But yes, no, that was paid for.
And was it a school bus or was it a...
No, it was a service bus.
So do you remember where the bus went? Which way did it go?
Went from here to Newby Bridge and then through to Ulverston. In the morning, it went all the way and we didn't change, but in the afternoon coming home, we had to change at Newby Bridge.
And what were your memories of secondary school? Do you remember which subjects you studied?
Yes, I studied... everybody had to do, I think it was 5 subjects for a school certificate, and I did chemistry, physics, biology, French, English, anything else? Well, that's about 5. In the upper school, in the sixth forms, I did chemistry, physics, and biology, and those were my main things. I spent a lot of time playing rugby and cricket. I actually became captain of rugby and captain of cricket as well, and in my final year I was Victor Ludorum for the running sport as well, and I'm now paying the price of that, as you may have noticed, limping around everywhere.
So Vic, did the school compete against other schools locally?
Yes.
Which other schools would you have been playing against?
Barrow Grammar School, Heversham Grammar School, St. Bees. We played against their second team. The two public schools, Sedbergh and St. Bees. What else?
Well, was it a league? Was there a...
No. These are just friendlies.
Friendlies, yes, okay.
Fairly friendly.
And what kind of extracurricular activities were there at school? What did you do when you weren't studying hard and playing sport?
Well, there was always a fell walking club. I was never in good at music, so I wasn't in the orchestra. They did have a bit of an orchestra. I was in the play. One day they had an annual play. It was mainly sport, actually, I have to say.
Did you play for the Cartmel Club at all? What were some of your exploits playing for Cartmel?
Well, I played for Carlton all the time I was at grammar school, but of course only in the holidays, because Saturday was taken up playing for the school. That came first.
Is that cricket or rugby?
Well, cricket. There was no rugby club at Cartmel.
Okay. How many teams did Cartmel have in those days?
Two.
Did you play in the first team?
Yes.
From what age?
I was about 15.
What was your speciality?
I was a batsman.
You were a batsman?
Yes.
Okay.
If you have the book, that Twixt Cock and Fairy, I'm in that in that period.
So maybe you could just tell us about the title of the book, where it comes from.
The title of the book is called Betwixt Cock and Fairy. These are the two hills on Cartmel Park, little hummocks. One is Cock Hill, which I believe got its name possibly from a place where cockfights took place at some ancient days. And Fairy Hill, I don't know how it got its name, but that's what the book is called. And it's a history of Cartmel Cricket Club, which has a very significant history, actually. You'll pick that up better from the book, but it was one of the very earliest cricket clubs, and certainly the earliest in this area. It began, I believe, as a cricket club for the workers at Holker Hall, and the first games were played there, I think. It only later became Cartmel Cricket Club.
What were the facilities like? Did they have the clubhouse as it
yes,
is today?
Did. Yes, yes, that must have been very early on, and there's certainly a picture of it in that book. They played in the Westmoreland League. That was a league, and it was quite a competitive league. And of course, from year to year, they had good and bad years, like all clubs of that kind. I enjoyed playing cricket at Cartmel, and they played in lovely places. Ambleside had a lovely cricket ground, and Cartmel was a good cricket ground. There were lots of people. They were nearly all in Westmoreland.
And did the village have a football team in those days also?
The village, yes, they did have a football team. I didn't play with them.
Vic, could you name some other teams in the area that were playing here in Cartmel that you played against?
Yes, Wharton, Arnside,
did Grange have a team?
Windermere. Grange, no, in my time, there was never a cricket team at Grange. They had attempted from time to time to make a cricket team at Grange, and for some reason it never lasted. I don't know why that was, but we had players from Grange playing at Cartmel. We had a pretty good team during the period when I was working, actually. They were quite successful in the league.
So Vic, you've been telling us a little bit about life in the village during the Second World War.
Yeah.
And I think you'd started to say about some evacuees who came here. Can you
yes,
tell us
about
that?
Yes, in 1940 we had, I think they were probably all from one school because they were all fairly close. And they came from Salford and were spread around the village.
So were these schoolboys?
Both, boys and girls. Oh yes, yes, they were all schoolboys and girls.
And so the age would have been similar to you, would it?
Yes, yes, yes.
And how were they put up? How were they housed around the village?
They were billeted on with families. The house next door to us had two. I think they were called Anselm. Just up the road there was a... I had a good friend among them, he called Ronnie Freeze, I remember. But there were boys and girls, and they were just with families.
So the families came as well? They came...
No, they were just the children. They were billeted on Cartmel family, with Cartmel families. This must have been quite standard, I think, in the at that time.
And they would attend school locally as well?
They came to the Cartmel school, yes. Yes. And they integrated extremely well. There was a teacher, I don't know what you would call him exactly, who came at intervals, not weekly, but less frequently than that, and they would all go into the senior classroom and the Cartmel kids were somewhere else, because he was here to teach them. It was a religious instruction, and he wore a funny hat, you know, and he was a
rabbi.
I don't know what you would call him. That's all. He wore a skull cap, but.
But you said the school, the children.
He came for one day, about once a fortnight, or maybe even once a month. I don't know. And they had received instruction in. Whatever it was, I don't know.
Because you said they were Jewish.
They were all Jewish, yes.
So it was a Jewish school in Salford.
Yes.
Okay. And how long did that last for? Do you know when they went back?
I think they dribbled away in. I think it didn't last for the whole duration of the Second World War, because I think the requirement disappeared as the Allies...
There was less bombing, I think, wasn't there?
Yes, the Allies eventually had complete air superiority, and the bombing went over. There was another wave of evacuees late in the Second World War who came from London, and they were... I can remember only one, but there weren't a lot. There were probably the original ones from Salford. There may have been 20 or 30, but later on, and this was when the V bombs started to, the V1s and V2s started to drop on them, and some they came from London. How official that was, I don't know. No, it must have been, they weren't privately sent. So there were evacuees, but they were a different lot altogether, and they were a very small number.
I think somebody had said separately, Vic, that an army regiment or division had been stationed in the village or just outside of the village. Do you recall that?
At Cark, there were two camps down at Cark. There was an airfield, mainly for training, I think, and army barracks as well. But they did a lot of anti-aircraft gunnery there, and that was right from throughout the war, as far as I remember. There were two separate camps.
And did the soldiers mix with the local people? Was there much interaction?
I can't say that.
Okay.
Yes, I think they must have done.
Okay. So if we just follow the timeline through, the end of the Second World War, you'd be 15, I think, if you were born in 1930.
Yes, that's right.
So you were still in the village for a bit longer before you
yes,
went
I
to
was.
University.
Yes.
So you would have left the village when you went to university. You would have been 18, I suppose.
No, that's when I went to. I went to university in 1949. I'm totally wrong. I was starting my national service in 1949, and I finished in 1951. It was just 2 years.
But you had been ill a year, so you were a year older, weren't you?
Yes.
So
I didn't I was 19 when I left school to join the Air Force.
You'd been ill when you were 12.
Yeah. Yes, I was a year behind my contemporaries because I was I had pneumonia and was laid up for quite a long time as a first year at grammar school and started again. So I was in fact 1 year older than the kids, my contemporaries at school. But that's the 1949-51 the Air Force. 51 to 54 as an undergraduate in London, and then from 54 on.
So after the war finished in 1945,
yeah,
until you left to go and do your national service, you're still in the village at that time?
Yes, oh yes, I was living here.
You're living in the house that we're in today?
School, yes.
Right.
In the senior years.
So how did life change during that period, after the end of the war? Rationing, for example, how long... And did he feel the effects of rationing?
Yes. Rationing went on for quite a long time after the Second World War, and I can't tell you when it ended.
What kind of things were in short supply?
Oh, meat, fats and sugar. There were no such things as sweets, candy in the war. There was nothing of that kind. And it took quite a while to get that going. I can remember quite well that when I went to Germany in 1950, when I was in the Air Force, there was much less rationing in Germany than there was here.
Why would that have been?
Well, I don't know, but it was a fact.
Did people in the village go hungry, or was it just
no,
the...
I don't think so. We certainly didn't. We had a pig and hens in the back here. We always had a pig and hens. So we were quite well placed for that sort of thing. Eggs and ham.
What did your parents, what did your father do in the war?
He did his ordinary job, his ordinary civil service job.
Okay, yeah. So he wasn't called up for...
No. He was too old then. Yeah.
He went round an ARP man though, didn't he?
Oh yes, well he was a special constable. That wasn't his job, but yes, he was a special constable.
What did that entail?
Walking around the village and telling people if their lights were showing through if the blackout wasn't complete, and just to see what was going on in the village. They went round in pairs.
But you told us that there was a police presence in the village.
Yes, there was a policeman living in. There was a policeman in the village, but special constables were not the same. There was the ARP, that's the area precautions, and there was the special constables, of which my father was one, and of course there was famously the Dad's Army, the Home Guard. The Home Guard was originally, when the war started, it was called the Local Defence Volunteers, abbreviated to the LDV, known as the Look, Duck and Vanish.
Sorry, say that again?
It was called the Look, Duck and Vanish
Look,
Brigade.
Duck and Vanish.
That was the LDV. But it became the Home Guard, and everybody knows about the Home Guard from Dad's Army, and it was very likely that. So those were the sort of wartime groups that were organised officially, the Special Constables, the Air Raid Precautions, ARP, and the Home Guard.
What kind of activities would the Home Guard have been getting up to? Because
actually they didn't get up to much at all apart from training. I mean, they would meet in the village hall and get the instructions from regular army sergeants or something who would arrive, and they would have to learn about shooting in the rifle. They had a little an assault course actually in the Priory Gardens, so they could run around and jump over the walls and climb up ropes and things like that, like an assault course. So it was training. It was just like military training.
And it was a volunteer force, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
So how many people about would have volunteered from the village? How big a force was it?
I think I could make a fair old guess about that, because as boys we used to go and sort of almost train with them. There must have been about 20 or 30.
Out of a population, how big was the village in those days?
500.
It was 500 people?
Mm, yes,
really?
So
that's actually feels like quite a small number.
It was a small number. You mean in the Home Guard?
Yeah.
There was the Special Constable and the ARP, and there was one other thing as well. And I don't know what this was called, but there were another organisation were the they met and slept, went out at night and all sorts of up onto the fell, I think, and in other places they were spotting for enemy aircraft. And I can't think of what the name was.
And parachutes and things.
Yes.
So it was a lookout.
Yes, there were. And I can't think. I think they did. It was called the Observer Corps. That's right, the Observer Corps. So that was what I missed out, of course, there were of course the women's volunteer organisations.
Like? Would they have names?
WVS.
The Land Girls.
Well, there were certainly Land... Yes, there were...
WVS.
WVS, Women's Voluntary Service. That's right. And they would do anything. I mean, but they were... No, the Women's Voluntary Service.
They made tea, didn't they?
Yes, and they were sort of universal ants. They helped people. And they were fundraisers too. They did a lot of fundraising, the WVS.
Did you get any American soldiers in the area?
Not in this area, except once... before the invasion, before the D-Day, probably for a couple of months or so before D-Day, there were Americans in the army camp down at the at Cark, and they came up here to the pub at Cartmel in all sorts of vehicles. It was quite exciting, actually.
So after the war, things got back to normal quite quickly, did they?
No, it was slow. I would say it was quite slow. When you say things got back to normal, rationing went on for a long time.
But the activities of the Special Constables, the ARP, the
I think
DLV, these all...
Yes, the requirement was gone. So I guess they all abandoned. The cricket club got going.
Had it stopped during the war?
Yes, yes.
And when did you start noticing growth in the village? New shops opening, new activity, new people coming to buy houses. When did all that start?
Can you switch off a minute? I have to think, but there was a shoe shop and vegetable shop and other things.
Fish and chip shop.
The fish and chip shop, yeah.
Where were they all, Vic? The cobblers, for example.
Well, that's what I would like to... If we had a map, I could point them out. If we start here and go down... on Cavendish Street, where the smithy was, where the Long Clume is now, almost opposite there was the shoe shop, Mr. Waring's shoe shop. There was a cobbler as well. He was shoe shop and repairing shoes. The warehouse for Mr. Eccles' fruit and vegetable wholesaler was, as it were, next to the Long Clume, going along, going towards. It's a house now, but it was a warehouse. And he delivered fruit and vegetables as far away as Ambleside in the area. And he had a retail shop where if we go down here, here is the priory, and then there's a house.
A big Georgian house.
Sticking out.
And then
the,
a little, smaller, lower house that's been done up. Just recently,
you know,
and big gardens at the back.
Well,
that's
that,
where he lived.
That,
yeah.
Where who lived?
Mr. Eccles.
No, he lived at Woodbrook. That was it. The retail. That was a retail fruit and vegetable shop. And there was a house. There was a house where Lady Beard lived, and then there was the retail shop. Going along Cavendish Street, we got past the shoe shop. Then there's the pub on the left, which is the Cavendish Arms. And going into the square, there was...
there was Frankie's, the little low one that was a little cake shop.
Oh, yes.
Wasn't there?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yes. Dead opposite to the Cavendish Arms. Are you with me now? Dead opposite is a long, rather low building, which was the doctor's surgery for a while. But early before that, it was run by Frank Campbell, a man called Frank Campbell, and Mrs. Campbell, who had run a little restaurant in there. There weren't much in the way of restaurants, but they had a restaurant there, and... probably how you'd call it a tea room, and they had a confectioner's shop in there. Then going into the square, there was the post office on the, as you go through the arch, immediately right, the present shop was always there. That was a general grocer's shop and the post office. Then the building facing you with the little pillars, that was a tobacconist, sweet shop, Mrs. Unsworth.
Now, you mentioned the Unsworth. Was the garage on the corner opposite Long Clume in those days? Or opposite the smithy?
No, they did have a garage. The garage was where...
The cafe.
Where the present architects... No,
no,
he's,
the
no
cafe.
He's moved. He's moved.
The cafe.
Yes,
the Mallard.
Yes.
And that was pumps. Petrol pumps, and when we went into the common market, they were too near the road, so they had to go, and then the whole building was brought forward and to the road, and it was made into a cafe, the Mallard Cafe.
Yeah,
yeah.
That was the filling station.
That was the
and garage.
The Unsworth.
And where Unsworth Yard is, you know, That was the yard where they had a couple of lorries and all the car repair workshops.
But the building which is opposite what is now Longclune today would have been the smithy then. That's yes. Just a sign on the wall.
Yes, it
a rally
has. And it's
sign.
Always been there.
Oh, yeah, that sign's been there forever.
It was always just like a barn.
But that building with the rally at the back, that was essentially a part of the smithy. That belonged to Billy Watson. The
it was just like a barn.
I don't know what... Yes, it was...
It looks exactly... When those doors...
It was a store.
It looks exactly the same now as it was then.
Yes, I think that was part of the blacksmith's operation.
And from that, the road that leads down to the house behind, that was always the doctor's house, wasn't it? Doctor...
Yeah.
That delivered you.
Dr. Charlton?
Yeah, Dr. Charlton lived there.
That's the house at the bottom of the... There's a long drive across the field.
And there are two properties,
yes,
aren't there?
Yes, yes.
No,
it was
there was
one
just
property.
Only one then, and his garden.
Yes,
They've made the other property since.
The other
it was a house lodge.
That stood on its own, wasn't it? Dr. Charlton's house stood alone, didn't it, there?
Yes, but... It was an extension built.
Well,
it's now like two houses.
His
yes.
garage.
Yes, it was just one house, and his surgery was actually inside the house. So what the other bit was, I don't know. But then, in the square, there was a confectioner next to the Unsworth thing, Mrs. Howson. Then there was the little alleyway. Then the bank, which is on that. You can see on that photograph now where the next door to the Priory Hotel, which was always called the Priory Hotel, was Fred Brown's shop. He was a baker. That was a baker's shop.
The boot shop on the corner?
Sorry?
The boot shop?
That was either empty or a bookshop. I think it probably was just a store for the bookshop. The bookshop wasn't the bookshop there. The bookshop is the shop which I've just told you, just described as Mrs. Howson's confectioners. She gave up and he took it over as a bookshop. And then he gave it up as a book... His store became the shop. It was hardly ever there. He has a much bigger bookshop in Kendal, or he did have it. He's not there anymore. He was quite an interesting character, Mr. Norman Kerr.
Why so?
Because he was an expert. He was very knowledgeable about railways. He was a very keen railway person, and in the Second World War he was actually engaged by the government because he knew a lot about the Continental Railway, about German railways in fact, where the junctions were and what they did and stations. So, and he was in fact engaged by some authority to advise them about German railways. So there's Fred Brown's baker, then another shop on the other opposite side of the bridge, which I mentioned earlier on, Miss Warriner's, again, the cigarettes and sweets.
Is that where Rogan's is today?
It's where Rogan's is now, yes.
Now, I've seen a photograph that next to Rogan's, there was a building which I think was a pub. Was it called the Bell?
The Blue Bell.
The Blue Bell.
Yes, yes. Now, that had ceased to be a pub in I don't know when, but before I came along. It was a private house, but became a cafe. Mrs. Mayer ran it as another confectioner's and cafe.
What was the name, Mrs.?
I think that was Mrs. Mayer. who had some connection with Bobby. I don't know where Billy Copeland came from, but he was connected with the Mayer family some way. Has he told you about that?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's where they were.
So as we continue,
did he tell you about? They may have moved at some time. Actually, I said to remember.
We can ask him that, Vic. Not
yes,
sorry.
Yes.
As you continue walking through, then in that direction, past the area where the petrol pumps used to be before they were moved.
Yes.
And we continue out towards the causeway.
Yes.
And then at the top of the causeway where there is the shop today, was that shop there?
Yes, that was Sid Hull's general grocer's shop. And Marion Airy, that we were speaking about, was his daughter and lived and grew up there. And when she married George Airy from Field Broughton, and they continued, they ran the shop there. So that was a shop. We've actually missed out the Devonshire Square, where the shop with all the sweaters and fancy goods and things. That was
the Larch Tree.
The Larch Tree. Well, that was always that had a very varied career. I think it was never very successful. It was sometimes a shop and sometimes a cafe, but it never quite. It changed hands a lot of times, I think. but the one called Hale's shop was called Ye Old Priory Shoppy, one of these awful. So that was always really another sweet shop and tobacconist.
Right.
And ice cream.
It was Mr. Turner, as I remember, to begin with, and then Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Cummings made the most delicious.
But that was the shops there. And then, as you say, going out past the petrol pumps, Cloggerbeck was the joiner's shop. Do you know where I mean by Cloggerbeck?
Yes.
Cloggerbeck. Well, that was Fred Burton's joiner's shop. He was the main carpenter joiner in the village. There were others who became apprentices there. And one, Harry Chambers, set up on a small scale joiner, a one-man joiner. But the joiner and undertaker was Fred Burton at Cloggerbeck, where he had machinery and so on. And that's about the lot.
So, Vic, any other memories of the village that would be of interest, do you think?
There was, briefly, in the late 40s, a boxing club.
A boxing club?
Yeah, yeah.
Tell us about it.
Well, Charlie Mayer, who, and I'm surprised if Billy Copeland hasn't told you all about this, Charlie Mayer was briefly a professional boxer. And so he became a sort of trainer for boys' club. And there's a boxing club which I was a member for briefly. I never really liked it much, but I retired undefeated. I have to say after two tournaments, there were boxing tournaments mainly. It was a bit incestuous. You kept having the same tournament by the same people, and they were the Barrow Sea Cadets had a boxing club, and they came here, and they were in the village hall. They had a ring set up, and and John Crowe, John Crowe from Field Broughton. He was one of the members who was quite active. He's still around. That must have been about 1946. It didn't last very long, but it was. I know we went once to have a contest with another boxing club at Preston, even. So it got as far away as that. That was something I'd forgotten about, but that was another of these clubs that we spoke about.
So you told us, Vic, that it felt like you never left because you kept coming back.
Yes, yes, it felt in that sense that we always had quite a strong connection. But a lot of things went on, like building, that I didn't notice or it happened when we weren't here. The village expanded somewhat with council houses, some private development, and so the council houses were the ones that went up on the Allithwaite Road. And they were specifically for old people.
You mean that?
Where Gladys lived.
Yeah, where Gladys lived.
I don't know. Headless
Cross.
I don't know. It's a small estate. I don't know what it's called, but
no,
that's Headless Cross.
And
otherwise, there were odd bits of building of private houses, one at a time, here and there. And then the ones which are now called...
I don't know her name, but that old lady that used to see to Gladys, she would have a book full of memories.
Yes.
Because she, I don't think she's ever left.
Are we talking now? Can you switch off a second? I've found on my computer some of the little articles I wrote, but I can't print them because my printer's conked out. I was going to give you them, but these are the things that appeared in the village comic. What's it called?
Parish magazine.
Yeah, but you say you have access to some of those.
We can speak to them and see if we can get hold of any.
But if they're on your computer, Vic, we could print them off for you.
Well, how?
Well, you could...
You'd have to find them first.
You could...
I could just email them to you.
It's
or get a stick.
A memory stick, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, we could bring one.
Well, I'm hoping that I'll get a printer working soon. But just conked out at just the wrong moment. Yes, I have found some of them on... they are actually... little descriptions of bits about Cartmel that I knew.
When you used to play in the woods down by where the tip was, and do you remember that where the on the road to Cark, that wood that's there, and you used to go across the pole on the river.
Oh, Sandy Pole River, yeah, yeah.
Well,
that's all in one of those. Yeah. One of those little articles, and about the about. Go on, sorry.
So, Vic, I think we'll probably wrap it up.
I think we're, we're kind of.
I think we've used all of your memory up, haven't we?
Probably not, actually, but.
if you think of anything else.
It comes in fits and starts.
We can always come back and do this again.
Well, I was actually thinking in terms of. At one time, this river was full of fish, and it was amazingly a salmon river. There was a late run round about late October of salmon that came up and spawned in Castle Meadows up there. And all the time I was a kid, there were fish in the river, and they've disappeared. They're absolutely gone. You can't see a single fish in there. No, not even eels. There were always eels and. But well, that's in one of these little articles, and I describe some
maybe what we'll do is read the articles and then come back and have one final session with you.
You but need one of your thanks, marine friends.
Thanks very much for today.
I know what you mean. I seem to have stalled a bit.
No, that's okay. So I'll stop the recording. I'll just repeat the date. It's the 6th of February 2016, and it's now just before 12 o'clock, and we've been with Vic and Pat Howarth. So thank you both very much indeed, and we'll close the recording there. Thank you again.
Okay.